From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
My grandmother could have fallen deeply in love, which he did with my grandfather, but had my great-grandfather, you know, signed off on it, it would not have happened. And so I also think that that speaks to my grandfather, something naturally within him. Before they were able to help him polish himself off and help him get into school and educate himself. And that's where my great-grandfather, by the way, was coming from. I mean, he was like, he saw something in him, but he also was like, okay, son, now if you're going to be with my daughter, you know, you got to clean your act up.
Isaac Newton Ferris Jr., former CEO at the King Center, grandson of Dr. Martin Luther King Sr. and nephew of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In the release of Daddy King, published by Beacon Press, the new foreword was written by Ferris. There he shares what Daddy King meant to him as a family member. Originally published in 1980, Daddy King chronicles the life of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Sr. In the book, King Sr. recalls the joys and struggle of his journey, the pain of leaving his mother and father and siblings on the farm, the triumph of winning voting rights for African Americans in Atlanta, and the feeling of fatherly pride and anxiety as he watched his son put himself in danger at the forefront of the civil rights movement. Daddy King gives us an understanding of what hardship and experience of racism that Martin Luther King Sr. went through and how he developed his method of political dissent that became a major influence on his son, Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Johnny L. Henson Jr. and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Daddy King, an autobiography, part two with Isaac Newton Ferris Jr. in Black America.
Here again, that's where I think the love of my grandfather for her came in, because as he said, he knew that she ultimately probably could never be happy anywhere else.
Right.
But at the same time, he knew that was a temporary fear, as you stated. First off, you know, in his mind, like I said, this was by this time, a young, hot preacher.
Mm-hmm.
So in
mm-hmm.
his mind, look, you know, he's like, Alberta, don't worry about that, babe, because I'm going to be preaching a whole flock of new people in here. By the time I'm through, you know, we'll have a whole new set of people. And that did eventually happen. No way would she have been happy, I think, ultimately anywhere else.
In 1980, Martin Luther King Sr. published his memoir, Daddy King, an Autobiography, a chronicle that provides insight into the life and family that created Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Coming of age and the poverty and the looming threat of racial violence, to preaching from the legendary Ebenezer Baptist Church pulpit for four decades. Candidly, he reveals his life inside the civil rights movement, illustrating the profound influence he had on his son. Born Michael King on December 19, 1899, to a family of sharecroppers in Stockbridge, Georgia, King Sr. came of age in the looming threat of violence at the hands of white landowners. Growing up, he witnessed his family being crushed by the weight of poverty and racism and escaped to Atlanta at the age of 16 to work and to further his studies. From his mother, King Sr. learned how important it was to stand up for what was right. When he went on to become a pastor with his father-in-law at Ebenezer Baptist Church, it gave him a position from which he could reach out to those in power in order to make a difference. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Isaac Newton Ferris Jr., grandson of Dr. Martin Luther King Sr.
Before they finally got married, he then turned and was doing the opposite. He was pushing them to hurry up and go ahead and get married, because he said, the way y'all gonna end up in trouble and make a mistake here. And so you need to go ahead and get married so that everything will be legitimate, because he saw the amount of affection between them. And so I think the last thing he wanted to happen is that, you know, my aunt would end up pregnant or something of that nature. So once he jumped on board and then was the main cheerleader. Hey, you all need to go ahead and do this. And he loved my aunt. And I think if he were here today, certainly if he were here today, no disrespect, because she is still alive. I mm-hmm. won't mention her name, the woman. But there's just no way that she could have been the life partner that my Aunt Coretta was to my uncle. And certainly you can make an argument that, that she was maybe in some ways a better partner in death than she was in life. I mean, we would not have a King Holiday were it not for my Aunt Coretta.
I found it interesting in the book where your granddad was committed to civil and civic advancement, but coupled with that, but also the economic equivalent to that, and his fierceness in going back, getting individuals to vote, but also going back to City Hall week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out, and walking past that white-only elevator.
Yes, yes. And that's another thing, another, and I alluded to this earlier about my uncle not being a fluke. You know, my uncle as a young boy saw my grandfather march on Atlanta City Hall
exactly.
over those drinking fountains. And I tell you, you know, people talk about the March on Washington, but at no point did my uncle ever fear for his life in leading the March on Washington. And nobody ever thought, okay, that he his life would be in danger, you know, leading the March on Washington. I mean, when you talked about the March on Washington, they were talking about the logistics and how are we going to deal with all these people. Nobody ever thought about any physical harm.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta, Georgia, you know, one of the former capitals of the Confederacy,
right.
A black man in the late 30s, early 40s, marching on Atlanta City Hall. I mean, even if you marched and you were a party of one and you didn't have any protesters with you, you were liable to be lynched.
Exactly.
Just for, you know, a party of one walking up the wrong way to City Hall, much less leading people in protest over, you know, the policies inside. So this obviously, you know, planted a seed in my uncle. And here again, that's another reason why we thought it was important to share this story, to show the linkages. And to show that this guy was not just, you know, a one-hit wonder, that there's real history of how this evolved.
Go ahead. Talk to me about your grandmother. They say behind every great man there's a great woman, but your grandmother was truly, truly a great woman.
She was, and it's no question that that rings true in the life of my grandfather,
mm-hmm.
and he talks about that in the book. First off, my grandmother was a very secure woman within herself,
right.
Grounded in the right way, because understand now that Ebenezer Church that is on the National Historic Register of Places, the place where my grandfather preached. My grandfather built that church,
mm-hmm.
With his own funds. And understand that back in that day, that was considered a very large church.
Right.
Right? So this was a thriving church with a thriving membership. In comes into town this uneducated, uncouth, you know, guy from Stockbridge, Georgia, who had a sister that the family had taken in.
That's Woody, right?
That's my Aunt Woody,
mm-hmm.
Trying to help her out. And she had a lot more training and education than my grandfather.
Right.
But here comes this guy who comes to visit one day his sister and meets my grandmother. And for him, you know, he immediately was attracted to her.
Right.
I don't know that my grandmother was immediately attracted to him. And I'm painting this picture because even though these were trying times within the black community, not just here locally here in Atlanta, Georgia, but nationally, mm-hmm. A.D. Williams was somebody.
He was a man.
He was the man. And so in the black world, this was, you know, a leading family.
Exactly.
And my grandmother was educated. I mean, she had gone, you know, to Marsh Brown and Spelman at that time was not a college. It was kind of a preps. Yeah, prep school. So she was fully educated by the time that this guy showed up. Had been to college and was thought to be, you know, a pick. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were families across the country that wanted these families to unite. So exactly. One, I think that speaks to her ability to look beyond the surface and to look into the man's heart and soul and to see something. And then I have to also, in that same note, say about my great-grandfather. He saw something in my grandfather because he took him in as well his. And trust me, in that day, I mean, I know I talked about my grandfather and my uncle and my grandfather having picked out the woman for my uncle. Now, by this time, this was in the 50s. Now, right. Now we're talking about back in the 20s. And trust me, if the father didn't want you, you didn't marry.
It didn't happen.
Okay. Exactly. I don't care if you had a sister that would lend you money for the engagement. It wasn't happening. I mean, it was not happening in that day. So my aunt, my grandmother could have fallen deeply in love, which he did with my grandfather, but had my great-grandfather, you know, signed off on it, it would not have happened. And so I also think that speaks to my grandfather, something naturally within him, before they were able to help him polish himself off and help him get into school and educate himself. And that's where my great-grandfather, by the way, was coming from. I mean, he was like, he saw something in him, but he also was like, okay, son, now if you're going to be with my daughter, you know, you got to clean your act up.
Exactly.
I see a little potential, and I think you can clean it up, but you got to clean your act up, son. You got to get education, and you got to, you know. So, and that was his intent. That aside from bettering himself, he wanted to be able to marry my grandmother, and my grandfather, my great grandfather, kind of laid it out for him. So, unfortunately, he did not. I don't know at the time. I was going to say, unfortunately, my great grandfather ended up passing shortly after they were married. I think about 4 or 5 years, because it was actually my mother, as a young child, who found my great grandfather.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I say this to say that, you know, I don't know what his intents was. I guess probably he would have wanted his son-in-law to follow him within the church. But it was more about, you know, some people say, you know, my grandfather came to town and saw the church and said, hey, you know, I'm going to be pastor of that church, and in order to be pastor of that church, I'm going to marry the pastor's daughter. But what people forget is it just wasn't happening like that back in the day, especially for an uneducated sharecropper son coming into to town to, you know, one of Atlanta's leading families. Right. So they definitely saw something in him that swayed them that way. And so my grandmother, being the rock that she was, supported him throughout his life. He could not have done what he did, leading that march.
Exactly.
Like he did. He could not have done that without her support. And she was a quiet mover and shaker herself. A lot of people don't realize, you know, back in that day, even by the time that when my uncle came along, you know, women's roles were a little, you know, a little more hidden than they are today, so to speak. You know, if the movement were happening today, like if you look at a lot of those pictures, you know, you don't see my aunt at a lot of those places.
Exactly.
That would not be the case today. But it just wasn't, aside from the safety issues, it just wasn't, you know, women just were not.
That wasn't the
it's
protocol,
visible.
Right?
Yeah, the protocol just. But believe me, my grandmother was right there.
I'm glad you brought up the point about your granddad, Daddy King, coming to town and wanting to be a minister, but not necessarily wanting to be the minister and pastor of Ebenezer. And when great-granddad passed, he was kind of reluctant to come to Atlanta and pastor yes. Ebenezer Church because he didn't want people having that same type of attitude that you just articulated, that right. he was marrying the pastor's daughter to become pastor of her daddy's church.
Right. And also, too, by this time, you know, they had polished him off or helped him polish
right.
himself.
He was doing
off.
Pretty well.
And it, right.
by himself.
Yeah, he was. And so he was like, you know, we'll be all right. I'm pastoring these churches, you know, and any minute now, I'm probably going to have to give them up because, you know, I'm in demand everywhere and people right. like my preaching. And so I'm probably going to get called by one of the big, you know, pastors, if not here in New York, because, you know, one of his best friends was
up in New York. Went north, right.
Right, right. So he was not necessarily, and also, too, you know, I stated that Ebenezer, certainly for Atlanta, was a large congregation, but there were larger congregations up north. And so, yeah, it was not necessarily, but I do think that that's where the love for my grandmother came into play. I think ultimately he decided to go ahead and accept Ebenezer because of my grandmother. I mean, she grew up in the church. Her father built that church. And so he said it later in life to us. I mean, there was no way that he could uproot, you know, my grandmother like that. He knew that she could never probably form that type of tie to another church, regardless of where they went. So he decided to come on in. Ultimately, it was a good decision, and ultimately, he became his own man there.
It's another caveat to that, Mr. Ferris, is that your grandmother also had some trepidation coming to the church that her dad pastored, is that all the members would know her as Little Alberta.
Little Alberta, right.
And,
right,
and Daddy King said, well, after time, we're going to have new members, and that particular train of thought is going to dissipate because you're going to have people there that wouldn't know you as Little Alberta.
That's exactly right. And here again, that's where I think the love of my grandfather for her came in, because as he said, he knew that she ultimately probably could never be happy anywhere else.
Right.
But at the same time, he knew that was a temporary fear, as you stated. First off, you know, in his mind, like I said, this was by this time, a young, hot preacher.
Mm-hmm.
So in
mm-hmm.
his mind, look, you know, he's like, Alberta, don't worry about that, babe, because I'm going to be preaching a whole flock of new people in here. By the time I'm through, you know, we'll have a whole new set of people. And that did eventually happen. No way would she have been happy, I think, ultimately anywhere else.
Exactly. Don't want to keep you too much longer, Mr. Ferris.
Sure.
But what is it like being a member of a family that held in such high esteem, not only in Atlanta, but worldwide? You are basically living in a fishbowl.
Yeah. I mean, but it's quite frankly an honor to be associated with a family that, and I not only say that, I say family, that one has, you know, committed themselves so to God and then to their fellow citizens. Certainly, at times, I would never say that it's ever a burden, but it constantly has me, and I think other members of my family, just kind of checking ourselves.
Gotcha.
One good thing that our parents did for us was, and as a matter of fact on this subject, you know, I was going to say one good thing that our parents did for us and my grandparents was they created an environment that essentially was, hey, be yourself.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, there was one universal rule in terms of that throughout my entire family. And be yourself, but there's one thing that you cannot choose to do. And that is, you cannot choose to go into the ministry. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he's talking to the men in the family, or at that time, that was a rule that applied to the men in the family. And I can remember saying, because my grandfather laid down the law on that. He was like, you cannot choose to do this. You know, you have to be called by God to be a minister. I mean, he would say that. He says, as much as I'm glad that my sons followed me and I want my grandsons to follow me, but you cannot choose to do this. And I can remember saying all the time, well, granddaddy, what's the call? He was in, and I can hear him right now saying, son, my call won't be your call. So I can't tell you what your call will be, but I can assure you when you get it, you will know it. And when you get it, you won't be able to run from it. So they, you know, they prepared us pretty well in terms of the personal thing. My biggest concern now is I look around and I have a better, I think, appreciation for what I think some people have mischaracterized as the final years of my uncle's life. You mm-hmm. know, supposedly he was depressed and all of that. I don't know that he was depressed, but I think I now understand what people were picking up because I see it playing out now today. I think he came to realize that people didn't truly get the philosophy, the nonviolent philosophy. Because if you remember, it was the end of the 60s, that's when the Black Power stuff, mm-hmm. you know, started breaking out. And I raise that because I'm kind of concerned about what I see playing out now today. It's almost as if the millennial generation, and I'm sure this is what did happen. You know, it's like in school, they just saw the footage of the marches. And so they think that's the end all be all. In my talks around the country, I try to explain to people that really the march was like the atomic bomb option. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were steps before the march. And my uncle never, even if he had the technology, my uncle would never have said, hey, let's just show up at 3 o'clock downtown. I mean, you know, his marches were always permitted. And there was logic to that. First off, that started a dialogue between the marchers and the government, so to speak.
Right.
It certainly, you know, alleviated, which is why you did not see except in the most hostile circumstances. But, you know, that permit, you know, when somebody calls and says, hey, you know, Isaac's got 1,000 people down there and they're giving speeches. I don't know what's about to happen. That's when they pull out the riot gear, right? Because they don't know what's happening. I mean, if they know, they can say, well, yes, we know Isaac. As a matter of fact, we gave him the permit. Here's where he's going to be marching, just so you know. So at a certain time, you might not want to be, you know, at Block A because they're going to be marching through there. And so it you know, that's just the one thing. But it's like now, you know, something happens and then everybody says, well, hey, let's march. And I don't know how effective that mm-hmm. can be. You know, when you're doing things like the causes are great, but, you know, we saw in cases like in Ferguson and New York. I mean, you know, why would you want to go in Macy's and disrupt people from shopping? These mm-hmm. are the people you're trying to win over
exactly.
to your cause. If they're not necessarily, you know, I can see you going down to the police headquarters or the city hall. So I'm just... See, you know, I kind of veered off here, but that's the type of concern that I have now, and that's what I'm rededicating myself to and I'm leading the family to do, is that we've got to go back and really explain to people the philosophy behind what my uncle was doing and the tactical advantages that he, you know, availed himself to. Which in the end, I mean, he taught this country how to protest. I mean, that's the model that everybody's using now, which is good, but there's more than just the marching, is the point that I'm making. I mean, You know, I don't know. I'm sure you saw the reaction to the inauguration.
Yes.
And it was great to see that. And it was good to see that, and they did the right thing. But the one thing that everybody kept saying was, you know, okay, you know, how will we, you know, focus this? How will we take advantage of this? We saw the same thing with the Million Man March, Louis Farrakhan's thing. I mean, it was great to see a million guys out there, but what happens? I mean, the March on Washington, and I just not say this because of Uncle Emil's involvement, but we saw what came out of that, if you know what I'm saying. They left the Lincoln Memorial and went to the White House, if you remember.
Exactly.
Met with the president, laid down the law, and then Congress eventually, you know, but they had a plan is what I'm trying to say.
Right.
I mean, they knew for 2 weeks out before the march, okay, this is what's going to happen after the march. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to focus it. And so there's a lot of planning that I don't think people really appreciate that happened in the 60s. Think about it. I mean, to have the discipline to show up and not react.
Right.
You know, people don't realize there were training sessions to train people how to do this. I mean, nobody's, and I'm not saying that we have to take people to school to learn how to necessarily protest, but the point that I'm making is there's got to be some organization into
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
I think people don't realize how much or appreciate how much organization actually was happening during the civil rights movement. I mean, you see my uncle out there speaking and you see the marches, but before his speech, before the marches, there was a lot of organization, strategy, and planning that went on before you saw that final product.
Any final comments, Mr. Ferris?
Please, I would encourage everybody to read this book, pick it up. It's a true American bootstraps story. Like I said, if you change the race of the man, it would be that traditional American. You can make it in America if you work hard. Except the race of this man was the persecuted race in this country, so it was even harder. And so it's an inspirational story. So I would encourage everyone to read it, and it's educational as well.
Isaac Newton Ferris, former CEO at the King Center, grandson of Martin Luther King Sr., and nephew of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions at your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.